Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there, this is Sam Wong, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium and professor of neuroscience at Princeton University.
Well, Happy New Year, Sam.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everyone out there. We hope you had a terrific holiday season, got a little rest. I was in Italy, so I enjoyed that.
5 inches of snow here.
Right. Italy was definitely better. Well, while we were gone for the last couple of weeks, I think nothing else stopped in Washington. A lot's been happening since we spoke. There has been more cabinet appointments announced, and we're getting closer to the confirmation process. There's been clear evidence presented of Russian intervention in the campaign. And everyone has been following President-elect Trump's perpetual tweets about the intelligence community, about the Russian hack, about his opinions on everything. And Democrats are still scrambling, trying to figure out how to respond to all this. But what really caught our eye when we were figuring out how to start the new year was this really interesting online publication called Indivisible: A Practical Guide for Resisting the Trump Agenda, which has been generating a lot of attention. A group of former congressional staffers, including Ezra Levin, Angel Padilla, Leah Greenberg, and some others — Ezra and Angel were both students here at the Woodrow Wilson School — they've published a guide to how to oppose the Trump presidency in the years ahead. And the piece has gotten a lot of attention in op-eds in the New York Times, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. It's been discussed in many media outlets. And at the heart of their publication is the notion that presidential power is not unlimited, and it won't be in the hands of President-elect Trump. And in some ways, unexpectedly, they tell progressives to turn to the Tea Party as a model for how to oppose a powerful president and keep pressure on Congress. So we are honored to have Ezra and Angel join us on the show today. So welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
So let's begin with the basic message of the piece. Ezra, maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about how this publication came about, and also why you're turning to the Tea Party, which has been one of the most conservative forces in American politics in the last 6 or 7 years, as a model for what Democrats and what the left should be doing in the years ahead.
So I think, like many progressives after the election, I was shocked, as was my wife, Leah Greenberg, who is also a former congressional staffer, which is relevant for the rest of this story. We were down in Austin, where I'm from, for Thanksgiving break. And in addition to working through our stages of grief, we were also seeing some glimmers of hope. We saw that there were a lot of these private Facebook groups or mailing lists or other groups of other sorts that were popping up to resist the Trump agenda. There was a lot of energy that we're seeing already out there building. And we were meeting with a friend here down in Austin, hearing about her experience being an administrator of one of these private groups. And what she said, and we had seen this too, is that the folks on the ground that were looking to resist Trump knew that they could make calls. They knew that they could sign petitions, but they didn't know what else. They didn't know how they could really affect change in their member of Congress's behavior or in some way resist the Trump agenda through Congress. And Lee and I looked at each other and we thought, you know, well, we know what worked. We were in Congress when the Tea Party was building up and resisting an incredibly popular president with incredibly large margins. And what might be helpful here, our one contribution to this movement that is growing, could be to demystify how Congress works and show that there actually is a model for success for folks who are in this position, for folks who see a president who we believe is trying to undermine democracy and see a president who could very well be supported by Congress in doing that. So we threw together a first draft and then reached out to a lot of folks who were a lot smarter than us, who were also on the Hill or other advocates, to try to hammer out what ultimately became the Indivisible Guide. And we posted that to Google Docs, and it kind of went on from there.
I have to say, the Google document, I remember when you first posted it, it was exciting to see it, because I will say that compared with, I think there's maybe not that much appreciation for people who haven't seen that many cycles, that there is an unusually high amount of energy going into exactly what to do in the new Congress on the liberal side. It's been interesting to watch liberals who are normally, I would say compared with now, they've been complacent. And this is an unusually high amount of energy that appears to be out there. It's interesting to see.
It feels like a wake-up call post-election environment for Democrats. Could I just follow up with one question to Ezra? The premise, though, of your piece that all of you wrote, and just to make it clear to listeners, is that Congress, basically legislators, are defined by the electoral interests, that they are most concerned about being reelected. And so the heart of opposing them is to somehow disrupt the certainty they have that in 2 years they will be back in their positions of power. Is that right? Is that how you kind of understand Congress from your experience?
That's absolutely right. Look, every single member of the House of Representatives is basically running for re-election every day. I mean, it doesn't matter if the election is next month or if the election is in 18 months. They're thinking about how can they get next re-elected. And a lot of members of the Senate are thinking that too, whether their election is in 2 years or further down the line. And in order to get re-elected, they have to talk to their constituents and make their constituents feel that they really care about them. So there's a reason why Congress has an approval rating that's roughly on par with toe fungus, but that individual members of Congress are constantly being reelected. Reelection rates are incredibly high. And it's because members of Congress are incredibly good at convincing their constituents and local press that, you know, Congress is really messed up and they don't really know what they're doing. But Congressman Joe Bob, he really gets me. Every single member of Congress is very focused on that goal of convincing their constituents that they're representing them in Congress, which is why relatively small numbers of constituents can really change the behavior of members of Congress. They don't want to see their public events flooded with people asking them why they're supporting a wannabe dictator. They don't want to see local press that says, instead of Congressman Joe Bob cuts a ribbon at this new building, instead it says 10 people showed up at this ribbon cutting and protested this new atrocity that's being committed by the administration and why Congressman Joe Bob is supporting it. So what the lesson we learned from the Tea Party was is that you can have a real impact on how your member of Congress behaves by, one, acting very locally, focusing just on your member of Congress, because your member of Congress cares about you. And two, acting very defensively. The Tea Party understood that Democrats controlled the White House, that Democrats controlled the House, that Democrats controlled the Senate. They knew that they weren't going to be setting the federal policy agenda. But they also knew that if they didn't come up with their one policy idea and instead just rallied around the single effort of resisting President Obama's agenda, that they could have a large movement that was opposing everything coming out of Obama's agenda and the Democratic Congress. Democrats can do the exact same thing now. Progressives can do the same thing now. Even if you're a conservative and you don't like Trump's agenda, you can do the exact same thing now. If anything, we're in a stronger position now than the Tea Party was 8 years ago, because Donald Trump is a historically unpopular president and he has minuscule margins in the Senate and House.
So let's just follow up on that. I want to turn to Angel a little bit. Angel, Ezra's just been telling us about the way the Tea Party's operated and how congressmen and senators are obsessed with re-election. I wonder, given these ways of large and small action, I wonder, where were you when the Tea Party, as we were just hearing, where were you when the Tea Party really kind of came into full force? And also, I wonder if you have any ideas about perhaps applying some of these ideas to a current example. Say, whether it be, pick your favorite example about what's in the news these days.
Yeah, so I was, I worked for Congressman Gutierrez between 2009 to 2011. So I was there when, you know, we saw the rise of the Tea Party. And it was also during the long ACA debate. And so there were plenty of opportunities to see some of these groups active. I didn't see it so much in the district. I saw it mainly in our DC office. I remember this one. There was this March 2010. It was the March 2010 vote on the ACA, and there was a big rally.
The Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, on the Affordable Care Act, and there were actually two. There were competing rallies that weekend. It was there was a vote on the ACA, so people had come down to D.C., but then there was also this big immigration rally, which my boss, Congressman Gutierrez, that's his whole thing. His whole thing is immigration reform. He's been trying to, he's been working on this for years.
And this so is in Chicago. He's from Chicago.
He's from Chicago, yep.
Okay.
And so we had been working for months on this rally and preparing for it, and we basically had to lock ourselves in our office while this rally, this immigration rally, was going on, because Tea Party people were all over the hill in the halls. They were coming into our office. They were yelling at us. We had to lock our doors. They would just open up the mail slot and just start yelling at us.
Wow.
And, yeah, and then they even delivered this portrait of Congressman Gutierrez with a big X on it, a big red X on it, because they were saying that he was next for, you know, they were going to vote him out of office. So it was kind of a rough time to be on the Hill trying to work on.
That is amazing. I worked in the House back in the 90s, and I don't remember ever seeing anything like that. That is amazing.
Yeah, no. And I mean, again, this is, you know, this is my first time, you know, I just come to D.C. So this is what I experienced. It was a little bit nuts. But then in terms of a recent example, I mean, I don't know if Ezra's covered this, but on Monday there was that big, the Republicans voted to change the ethics rules, basically. And immediately they got a huge backlash, right? Tons of calls. We've heard about offices getting overwhelmed from people calling about how they were trying to gut the ethics process. And so I think it's those kinds of actions where you have people who are watching them, right? And they feel the pressure from their constituents that if they do these things, that they're voting, doing things against their interests, they're gonna suffer for it in the election.
Now, in the case of the ethics rule change that got rolled back, that brief brief moment of trying to, I don't know, refill the swamp or what have you, there are claims that Trump himself may have helped out with this with a tweet. Now, can you just, what do you have to say about the timing of the phone calls and about Trump's response? And what do you think the role of citizen anger was there?
I think it had nothing to do with the Trump tweet. I think he's an opportunist, honestly, and he saw that it was going in that direction, and he started tweeting. I think it's very clear what made the difference was not that tweet. It was the fact that people were calling their members and telling them that they were not going to stand for that kind of action.
Let me ask Ezra. Earlier, we were talking about how you all see Congress as working, and now we're hearing about what the Tea Party did to the Democrats that opened your eyes about how to disrupt the presidency. There's one difference some people might think between the Democrats and at least the current generation of Republicans, meaning Democratic legislators generally are interested in governance. They are interested in long-term careers. They believe in being part of Washington. And some would say the Tea Party Republicans, the post-2010 generation, doesn't really care. So they're willing to burn their own seats. They're willing to just be there for a couple of years, and they're more ideologically driven than caring about electoral pressure, and that you can yell and you can scream all you want, and they don't really care. And they're confident they'll be replaced by people just as conservative of them because of the district. So that would get to a fundamental part of the strategy. And I'm curious, is that wrong, or does it still work even if you have a different kind of legislator who you're talking about?
I actually think we should remember that in 2009 and 2010, there was no Tea Party member of Congress. They had not been elected yet. So the entirety of the Tea Party's impact on the discussion happening in Congress was the result of grassroots activists making existing members of the Republican Party and some members of the Democratic Party hear their voices and change their behavior. So if you're comparing a theoretical future indivisible portion of the Democratic Party to the Tea Party portion of the Republican Party, there might be some significant differences. But honestly, we're focused on the next 2 years right now. We're focused on what activists can do to ensure that Donald Trump and his lackeys in Congress don't simply implement the entirety of their agenda. And so for our purposes right now, if you are an activist on the ground, if you're trying to make your voice heard in Congress, pretty much the exact same tactics will work.
Angel, could I ask you, one of the aspects of the report that I think people find compelling, if you're sympathetic to the report, are the specifics in terms of how you do this. It's a kind of strategy pamphlet with very specific recommendations about how to change the minds of legislators right now, Republicans, moderate Democrats, when President-elect Trump put something, or President Trump at this point will put something forward. Can you walk us through two or three of the recommendations that you make?
Sure. So one of the main things that we try to stress is that there's a tendency to, you know, you see an action alert, you know, about calling members of Congress or call this specific office, call Congressman, call Speaker Ryan, because he's the one who controls what goes to the floor in the House. And so what we want to let everyone know is that that doesn't really matter, right? If Congressman Ryan isn't your member, he doesn't really care what you think. I know that seems a little bit counterintuitive, but it really just matters what your member of Congress means. You have two senators and one representative, and they want to make sure that they get reelected. And so if you're signing off to these online petitions, if you're calling someone else's member, you're pretty much, you might not be wasting your time. I mean, it's good energy to have, but really, if you want to be effective, you should focus on your members of Congress.
And to follow that up a little bit, does that mean that if you're going to focus on your own senators and your own member of Congress, should you call the Washington office or the local office?
So, you know, what we saw was most effective back in 2009, 2010, and in the, you know, the years following, is that those kind of local action is really, really important. So, you know, every member has a district office, right? And so ideally what we want to see are groups of people, you know, your friends, your neighbors, going down to the district office and letting your member of Congress know that you have, you know, you expect things from him or her. And again, I think a lot of people think that D.C. is just so far away. They don't understand the process. You know, they hear things like reconciliation or you know, markups. And it's stuff that they don't really understand. But the point is that you don't have to come to D.C. You know, you can stay at home in your neighborhoods, in your communities, and really make an impact by going down to the district office.
Well, that's helpful to hear that one can do it at the district office, because that's much easier, especially for people who do not live, say, in the Northeast or in the East Coast. So one thing that struck me here, and I think I want to ask Angela about this. One thing that really strikes me is that as congressional staff, people have finite numbers of staff, where it's around a dozen people on a congressional staff, similar numbers out in the home district, maybe larger offices in the Senate. But I'm going to read from Indivisible. And it says here, stall the Trump agenda by forcing them to redirect energy away from their priorities. Congressional offices have limited time and limited people. A day they spend worrying about you is a day that they're not ending Medicare, privatizing public schools, ending the Affordable Care Act, or preparing a Muslim registry. So that's really interesting to me. So is it really possible to gum up the works by simply getting up in their grill?
Definitely. I remember when I was a staffer, you know, there were a ton of meetings that you had. There were a ton of things going on. Again, you have to remember that there are, you know, like you said, a dozen staffers in an office, and they're responsible for everything, right? Like literally everything that's happening, there's someone that's supposed to cover it. So if they're distracted by something like a group that's coming in, a bunch of calls that are coming in, then they can't get to the work they're responsible for. And you know, I have, you know, so many memories of one every week or every few weeks, there was some big crisis that we had to deal with, right? And it had nothing to do with my portfolio as a staffer, but it dominated my work week. And then, you know, the other things just got put on hold.
Okay.
So it is definitely possible to go off the work.
Okay, so sucking up all their time. So let's see. So what about, Ezra, I just want to follow up on this a little bit. What about positive feedback? For instance, the other day, Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, said that he met with Donald Trump, and Trump said that there wouldn't be a repeal without replace. Is there value there to maybe get, for people who live in Kentucky, to call up Bowling Green and say something positive about what Rand Paul just did?
Absolutely. You know, one of the most common questions we've received over the last couple of weeks is, what do I do if my member of Congress is actually pretty good? What do I do if it looks like they are resisting the Trump agenda? And this could be conservative members who don't want to empower Trump. It could be Democrats who are standing strong. And so the question for those advocates is, if I'm not going in and yelling at them for doing the wrong thing, how can I ensure that they continue to do the right thing? And our bottom line answer is that if your member of Congress is doing the right thing, make sure they're bold. Make sure they continue to do the right thing, and make sure that they know that they have the support of their constituents to do that. So, in fact, the exact same tactics that we discuss in the guide that going to their district offices, like showing up at their public events, making calls, all of these can work even if your member of Congress is good. And what it will do is provide some really necessary positive reinforcement. I will say, looking at the kind of mail and communications that come into a given congressional office, in general, people are contacting you because they're not happy with something or they want you to do something that you haven't done yet. It's actually relatively rare to get a message that says, hey, good job. You really showed that person or you really stood up, and we really appreciate that. And those kinds of messages, those are the ones that get printed out by the legislative correspondent and taken to the chief of staff or the member of Congress, and they really like them. So providing that positive reinforcement is actually a huge help, and it will ensure that we're going to have a lot of really strong fighters in Congress resisting Trump's agenda.
Ezra, it seems that one part of what you've now done is look at the Tea Party, what tactics they used, and show that they were pretty effective at stopping the Democratic agenda. I mean, the other question that comes to mind is why the Democrats were unable to stop the Tea Party. And that's not just relevant for the history, but it will be relevant right now. Were there things that, and you probably don't want to give away secrets to your opposition, but were there things that the Democrats didn't do in these past few years that allowed these tactics to be more effective than they otherwise might be? And isn't that relevant right now as opponents of the Republicans and of the Trump administration are gauging what kind of response they'll encounter when they disrupt a ribbon-cutting ceremony or conduct a sit-in at an office? Why couldn't they stop this?
You know, Democrats, and not all Democrats, you know, my boss actually stood pretty strong. I think Angel's boss did as well. Many Democrats got really scared, and they simply moderated their positions in response to it. They hadn't ever really seen anything like this. I will say that I don't think the conservative offices that are being targeted now have really ever seen anything like what they're about to. So I don't know if there are any tools I would give the folks who are trying to implement Trump's agenda to resist the coming wave. I don't know if there is something they can do if people across the country are standing up to make their voice heard. That's democracy. That's the system we've got. So it's not really a question of how they respond to it. It's a question of how big that wave is that's coming.
Well, let's see. Let me follow up with Angel a little bit. Let me just take this as in a contrary way. So we just heard that maybe conservatives haven't seen any kind of liberal anger like this. But I want to focus and just turn it to something that's not quite in your document. But what about safe districts for conservatives? You said that conservatives, we just heard that conservatives have not really seen anything like this. But, you know, I feel that it seems to me that temperamentally liberals and conservatives are somewhere different where, I don't know, a lot of conservatives I know are pretty tough and confrontational, and they're used to hardball. I mean, they just lived through a primary season that was as rough as anything anyone's ever seen in American politics. So two parts to my question. One is, does that really work for, say, Democrats and liberals to push on conservatives? The other is that if somebody's in a conservative district, is it possible to give positive feedback when they stand up for, I don't know, civil rights or retaining medical care? I want to hear a little bit about what this looks like if we're trying to say, if Democrats and all of your followers are trying to hold back the tide on something that a lot of Republicans might like. Talk about that a little bit.
I think you're right. When it comes to safe districts, I work for a member who has been in office for 18 years, and he felt pretty safe. There are a lot of members like that feel pretty safe, and they're used to, you know, some small group of folks that are sort of always kind of harassing them, right? But that's the whole point, right? We need to shake them from that sense of security. And the Tea Party, even in some of these safe districts, in Democratic safe districts, they were louder, and they were out there, and they made themselves heard and seen more than the other groups. So I think it does matter in terms of. So if you think of like this ACA fight that we're sort of in the middle of already, even if you're in a safe district, I mean, you have 120 Republican members who are in Medicaid expansion states. These individuals, these members of Congress, are going to be voting to take away people's health care. Even if you're in a safe district, you should be scared because you're taking something away from a lot of people. And so you're not as safe as you might think.
I want to interject here that behavioral economics and behavioral psychology have found that people are more loss averse than they are to wanting a gain. And so when people have something, they don't like it taken away. And just putting on my neuroscience hat for a moment. So it sounds to me like a good strategy would be to pick these Medicare or Medicaid expansion districts and say, okay, why don't you get in touch with Senator Cotton in Arkansas and point out how many hundreds of thousands of people in your home state, Senator Cotton, are going to lose their health insurance, and we are aware of it. And so it seems like getting down in there and saying, you know, we're aware of the cost, that kind of thing. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about here?
So that definitely needs to happen, but what we don't want to forget is that it also matters. Like, even if you're not in one of these places, in one of these states, your members still need to hear from you, right? Because, you know, these are going to be long, difficult battles in Congress. And you need your member of Congress not to sit on the side. Even if you have a great member who's voting, his voting or her voting is consistent with your values and your interests, they need to be out there fighting for you. They can't just sit on the sidelines. And so, yes, there are a lot of groups that are out there, you know, honing in on those members in those states where there's a lot of people are going to feel sort of these losses the most. But we just can't forget those other members.
Okay, so that's fine. I still want to pull you away from it just a little bit. If a Republican member gets input from a progressive constituent, what's to keep them from shutting it out? How much volume is it going to take to get them to pay attention to that?
I think it needs to be jarring, right? I mean, if they get one phone call, a couple phone calls a day, they're just going to dismiss it, the same old everyday. The one or two people that call.
I see. But so it needs to be overwhelming.
It has to be overwhelming. It has to be, you know, people coming, literally walking into the district office, you know, and asking to see the member or asking to talk to a staffer. It has to be, you know, these overwhelming number of phone calls. It also needs to be sort of just finding them at their whatever they're doing out in the district. They're having some kind of, you know, they're at a hospital, they're at a school, you know, they need to feel uncomfortable. And so that's the kind of activity we want to see.
Could I ask, Ezra, I'm thinking this all through and I'm imagining how it will play out. And with Obama, you had a president who was pretty restrained in temperament and for much of his presidency reluctant to fully engage in the kind of partisan politics that is so much part of Washington. With President Trump, you have someone who is a master manipulator who loves to take everything and spin it in his direction. So when I'm hearing this, I could imagine a Richard Nixon kind of response, meaning as people are protesting in district offices and interrupting, you know, events in a district, that he spins this as, look, this is America out of control. Look at the liberal left that has no sense of order. Couldn't this backfire in a way it didn't for the Tea Party and become a symbol in some ways for Trump to use against the Democrats and to build support for the major argument he's been making? Or is this still effective even if he goes about doing that?
Yeah, so this, I think, strikes right at our theory of change here, which is that members of Congress, again, fundamentally care about what their constituents think and what local press says, because that's where they're running for re-election. If it shows up in the New York Times or other national publications that Trump tweeted something about this broad movement that's pushing back against his agenda, we're less worried about that, and we think that members of Congress are going to be more focused in on what their actual constituents are doing. Donald Trump's agenda does not depend on him or his tweets. It depends on members of Congress agreeing to him and his agenda and his tweets. And if their constituents are telling them that it's unacceptable, they're going to listen in one way or another.
If I want to, let's see if one of our listeners wants to find out more about this. We have more time, but I just want to interject now. What's a good place for them to find local people to communicate with? Your website or other websites? Just talk about ways that people can meet with one another and join forces.
You know, absolutely. So there were a lot of folks organizing for years and years before, you know, a handful of congressional staffers put together this guide. And we make no claims that we are the only game in town. All we're trying to do here is help the movement however we can. So at indivisibleguide.com, you know, one of the main questions we got was, where is there a group? How can I find a group? I have a group. I would like to get more folks engaged. So on Monday, this past Monday, a week ago, we started taking in group information. We said, register your group here. Let us know where you are, what your name is, and how folks can get in touch with you.
I see. So at indivisibleguide.com, it seems like you've got a start on getting this information. It feels like more information could be added. But I see that I would not have to go more than 25 miles if I were so disposed.
I had a friend who, after the election, one of the things he did, who lives in New York, he just put out on Facebook, this friend is a Democrat who is not happy with the election. And I remember he told me that he just put out on Facebook an invitation to people to meet at his apartment to all his Facebook friends. And he's been having several meetings since then, kind of informal dinners, what to do. Some of the things that you try to give structure to in your publication was a response. And I guess, Ezra, that leads me to the question. The other part of your manual, which I think is really interesting, is how you manage a small group. So part of it is the disruption. The other part is, what do you do when these people that get together? How do you make sure it's going to be effective rather than to dissipate? Could you talk a little bit about what you're all trying to argue about, how to make this an effective gathering rather than something that will fizzle?
Yeah. So one of the chapters of the guide is, you know, what do I do once I get this group together? How can I recruit folks? How can I make sure that the meeting is effective? And so we kind of go through the nuts and bolts of how you manage the meeting, deciding on a name, agreeing on a set of principles, figuring out what volunteers do, figuring out how you can communicate to the outside world and to others, and how you recruit more people to actually come. None of this is rocket science. This isn't so difficult. You don't have to quit your job. You don't have to start a new organization. The Tea Party was made up of a lot of folks doing this in their free time, and the movement we see happening right now is made up of a lot of folks just doing it in their free time, including Angel and I. So I think for anybody interested in getting into this, that the barrier of entry is really not high. If there's already a group in your area, it probably just means joining up on Facebook and going to the next in-person meeting. If there's not, it really just means setting up one of those Facebook groups or setting up another group somehow, sending an email out to your friends saying that you're doing it, and then starting the meeting in person. That's it.
Feels like this would be effective not only in Congress, but also in state legislators, because they even have fewer phone calls and fewer people who are in touch with them.
Absolutely. And so we've gotten that comment a lot. And we are not experts in state and local policy, so we kind of try to stay narrowly in our lane of expertise, which is how Congress works. But any elected official, regardless of at what level, is going to respond to these same tactics.
Can I ask, Angel, so now we're hearing more from Ezra about different tactics and how you manage small groups and more lessons from the Tea Party. I can imagine some people who listen to all of you, a group of Democrats, kind of tapping into what the Tea Party has done, raising the question, is this the best path? Meaning, for many Democrats, they look at the Tea Party and they argue that the Tea Party has been destructive in American politics, that it's created a kind of obstruction in government that, regardless of if you're liberal or conservative, is good. It's created a kind of theater of resistance, which leads into dangerous directions. There was a path to some of the uglier elements of the Trump campaign that really start with the Tea Party more than anything else. And so I imagine some people will ask you or wonder, is it possible to separate the more destructive sides of Tea Party politics that many Democrats see from these tactics that you're trying to draw out of the movement and say that even a progressive can use? Or are you just going to fuel a path in politics that will ultimately be detrimental to the left and the right?
So that's the question that we immediately got when we published the guide. You know, there were a lot of folks that thought that the Tea Party was so terrible and used so many terrible, said and did so many terrible things that they just couldn't really reconcile this idea of using their tactics. But I think what we think is, you know, you can separate the tactics, the useful tactics, from a lot of that nasty behavior that we saw, right? You know, Tea Party groups, we've seen them, you know, they say very hateful, racist things. I mean, I remember back in during the Affordable Care Act fight where you had Tea Party groups that were spitting on members of Congress. I mean, those kinds of things, we don't think We obviously don't believe in those kinds of behavior. We also don't think it's effective. But there are some very useful tactics that they use, and we outline those in the guide. Things like those coordinated calls or office visits or town hall events. Those are the kinds of things that we think are effective, and we do think that we can separate that from some of that really nasty behavior. And in terms of being obstructionist, you know, I think the stakes are so high right now. We're not trying to obstruct just to obstruct. What we're trying to do is protect what we value, right? You know, reproductive rights, immigrant rights, all of these things are so important that we want to stop the Trump agenda, and we think of it as protection, not obstruction.
Okay, so protect rights, protect what we have, visit them in person, and no spitting. Okay, don't be like them. No spitting. All right,
right.
I'm on it. I think I got the no spitting part under control. Okay, so let's hear. Okay, so let's go back. So you got 105,000 people and 2,400 groups.
That's right. So in the last 3 weeks that we've actually been taking in people's information, 105,000. Subscribers with zip codes in literally every congressional district in the country. Since Monday, a week ago, we started asking for people's group information. We have 2,400 plus folks who have registered their groups. And one of the really inspiring things, I'm following about 60 of these indivisible, quote unquote, indivisible groups. And they're not all called indivisible, which is great, but indivisible groups on Twitter. And, you know, I'm seeing indivisible Austin talk to indivisible Miami, talk to indivisible Chicago, and share the agendas for their meetings, or share how they found meeting space, or share what their plan is this week for calling their member of Congress. And it's building. It's growing on its own. We're not. You know, calling indivisible Austin saying, hey, you should do this. They're taking the lead.
Well, they may be taking the lead, but the thing is, there is a role for some kind of centralized people to cheerlead and so on. Because as I was saying before, look, I'm not exactly seeing Joe Biden out there in the way that one might like Joe Biden to be, or you know, President Obama, like I said, has a civil duty to actually facilitate a transition. So it's not exactly in his on his job description right now to go undermining any of these things.
Yeah, so I mean, the Tea Party was largely driven by the on the ground, and then there was some air support. There were some folks that were pushing out information, saying, "Hey, here's what's coming up in Congress," or providing some sense of shared identity that we're all part of this. We're all resisting President Obama. So you know, what Angel and I and others involved in the indivisible effort see our role as right now is doing some of that kind of light touch work, where we can push out more information that will hopefully be helpful to the real leaders on the ground, and we can facilitate those connections like we're doing with the directory up on the website that just went live.
I think you've got a busy year ahead of you.
That's right. Let me ask one last question. Maybe I'll direct this to you, Ezra. You guys published this as a Google Doc, and you're all very smart people, but this thing has really captured a lot of attention.
It's starting to take off.
It feels like one of those 60s manifestos that you read about in the history books that had a big impact. Why do you think the reaction has been as strong as it has to this?
Yeah, so I think the reaction has been strong because there is a movement growing. There is a movement building. And progressives across the country were feeling a lot of despair after the election. You know, we had not just lost the presidency, we still did not have the Senate, we were far from taking the House, we were decimated at the state and local level. And what the guide proposes is, again, there is a model for success. There is a way forward that we can begin to build progressive policy wins and resist the negative things that are about to come down the pike. So if there's one characteristic of that's shared among the majority of the communications we've received, it's that there is a feeling of hope that folks felt when they read this. And it's not you know, just all butterflies and rainbows hope. It's more of a steely-eyed kind of hope that, you know, it's not going to be really easy. It's not that we're going to win everything, but that there is a way forward. There is this model for success. And as far as I can tell, that's what folks were looking for. And we believe it's true. So we hope as many folks as possible do see hope in this document and do put it to use on their home turf.
It does seem like House staffers would be a good place to look for this kind of street fighting. And also does seem like it's a good time because there is a sense in which the Democratic Party is somewhat decapitated with Obama basically having to, you know, his civil duty is to facilitate some kind of transition. And Hillary is obviously out of action at the moment.
Well, thanks again to both Ezra and to Angel, two of the co-authors of Indivisible, A Practical Guide for Resisting the Trump Presidency, which you can find online. We appreciate that both of you took the time to be on our show. Thank you.
Thanks for spreading the word.
Well, that wraps up our episode. Thanks for joining us. Happy New Year. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.